Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Imagine that you had joined a church and you brought your whole family into the church and your son was increasingly involved in the church, kind of being primed to go out into a mission field and change the world, and you were so proud of your son. And you spent decades inside the walls of that religious institution watching your son grow into a position of greater prominence until finally your own child, your son, was the head of the church itself. And then suddenly, decades later, when you were in your 70s, you looked around and realized, hey, wait a minute. Perhaps my whole life, perhaps this whole church is a lie. And my son is helping to perpetuate that lie. David Miscavige is the leader of the Church of Scientology. His father's name is Ron Miscavige. Ron was once a devout member of the flock, right? He was once a devout Scientologist. He escaped the Church of Scientology in 2012. Last year, Ron published a book called Ruthless, Scientology, My Son David Miscavige and Me. Now, Ron's been out there pounding the drum, sounding the warning about Scientology. You may have seen him last year on ABC's 2020. His appearance on 2020, by the way, prompted an official response by the Church of Scientology. They said that Ron was, quote, seeking to make money on his own son's name. At one point, they threatened litigation against the publishers of Ron's book in both the U.S. and the U.K. They said that the book contained malicious, false, misleading, and highly defamatory allegations, allegations which, of course, the church denies. Now, over the years, much of the fog about the Church of Scientology has cleared. It used to be a big mystery. Like, Scientology was a huge mystery just a few decades ago. But with more and more people leaving the church, escaping, speaking out, writing their exposés, and producing their documentaries, HBO had a 2015 documentary called Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. Former Scientologists like Mark Headley busted out. Mark wrote a 2009 book called Blown for Good, Beyond the Iron Curtain of Scientology. By the way, blown refers to someone who leaves the church without official authorization. If you leave without permission, you're blown. David Miscavige's niece, Jenna Miscavige Hill, she escaped in 2005. She wrote her own book called Beyond Belief. She now hosts a website that she founded with other ex-Scientologists. That site is exscientologykids.com. We've recently seen the A&E television series Leah Remini, Scientology and the Aftermath, where she exposes the behind-the-scenes look of what the Church of Scientology is. And today, we're going to speak to the father of the head of the Church of Scientology. We're going to talk to Ron Miscavige about his son, David, about his life and his escape. First, though, real fast, in case there are some who do need a quick primer on what Scientology is, what the church states or believes. And this is a very general and brief overview, okay? Back in November of 2011, Michael Shermer wrote an article for Scientific American. That article was titled, The Science Behind Scientology, and he summed up the Genesis story of Scientology like this. Around 75 million years ago, Xenu, the ruler of a galactic confederation of 76 planets, transported billions of his charges in spaceships similar to DC-8 jets to a planet called Tegeac. Tegeac, by the way, is Earth. There, they were placed in volcanoes and killed by exploding hydrogen bombs, after which their thetans, their souls, remained to inhabit the bodies of future Earthlings, causing humans today great spiritual harm and unhappiness that can be remedied through special techniques involving an electropsychometer, or E-meter, in a process called auditing. Essentially, you are a god covered by this clumsy human skin. You have all of this baggage, the psychological baggage, that has caused you to forget that you were originally a god with godlike power. And so the church says if you have stress or unhappiness in your life, if there's conflict, if there are problems, it's because you need to get rid, you need to slough off all of this worldly, earthly, physical baggage, and you need to sort of become reintroduced to your inner Thetan, your godlike self. And so you enter in sort of a self-help model. You go in and you start getting sort of counseled with these self-help, positive, sort of touchy-feely messages about being a better person, having a better life. And then as you go deeper and deeper into the program, the amount of woo that is introduced to you increases. So they don't start off with stories about Xenu. In fact, Xenu hardly ever comes up, as I understand it. They talk about finding peace. They talk about centering yourself and balancing your life and maximizing the positives in your relationships. Those types of things are how they start you out, and they really get their hooks into you, and they get their hooks into your bank accounts and your financial resources. And in many cases, before you know it, you look up and you're not just in over your head, you are drowning in debt and red ink. You are absolutely imprisoned financially. You have mortgaged your whole life to the Church of Scientology. Tom Cruise is a hugely popular Scientologist. John Travolta and Kelly Preston, avid Scientologists. Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men, she's a follower. Kirstie Alley had claimed that the Church of Scientology helped her beat a cocaine addiction. Even Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson, is said to be a part of the Church of Scientology. Tony Ortega of Underground Bunker estimates that only 25,000 Americans are actually members of this church. That's one person in 12,000. But the Church of Scientology has been making a lot of headlines and generating a lot of controversy as more and more people come forward. The father of the head of Scientology has come forward. Ron Miscavige joins me in just a second. First, a huge thank you out to our show sponsor today, The Great Courses Plus. Professor Andrew Newberg is a neuroscientist and an expert on the human brain. Okay, the guy's a pioneer in the neurological study of spiritual experiences. It's a field known as neurotheology. And he's got this lecture series about belief in the brain at The Great Courses Plus. The course is called The Spiritual Brain, Science and Religious Experience. And Newberg's been involved in decades of research. You know, they examine and scan the brain during what people determine or claim are religious experiences. What cognitive processes are happening? Which parts of the brain activate or shut down? Is there a mind-brain distinction, or is it all the same thing? The science of the mind when it comes to religion. It's a hugely interesting lecture series at The Great Courses Plus. And I'm going to tell you how you can get 30 days of free access to that series and all of the over 8,000 lectures at The Great Courses Plus on a host of subjects, from science to cooking to music to history to hobbies and so much more. You can watch from your TV, your smartphone, your computer, or laptop. Let The Great Courses Plus turn those devices into your classroom, streaming this information to you in real time so you can know more, understand more, and engage more. Get your free month starting right now. Just sign up with my special URL. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Get your free month starting today. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. He has penned a book that LA Weekly calls compulsively readable. Publishers Weekly called it an excoriating memoir. The New York Times Book Review said it hits particularly close to home. The book is called Ruthless, Scientology, My Son, David Miscavige, and Me. And the author, Ron Miscavige, joins me here. Ron, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Seth.
So I'm speaking to the father of Scientology. Is that an accurate way to say it, Ron?
You would say I am the father of the chairman of the board in Scientology. And
yeah, I guess L. Ron Hubbard would be sort of the father of Scientology, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he'd be the founder. And that's a little different than the position David holds. He's he's what you refer to as the chairman of the board. He's the top gun. He runs it by himself. It's his whole thing.
The word on the street about your son is that he doesn't do interviews and he only appears at these sort of controlled events where he won't receive a challenging question from an investigative reporter or whatnot. He can come out, speak at the podium in the affirmative, big cheer, and then he just sort of disappears, goes back into the inner workings of the Church of Scientology. Would that be an accurate way to say it, Ron?
That's precisely how it is. He doesn't give interviews. He did an interview many years ago with Ted Koppel, I think the guy's name was, and that was on television, and that was live, and that was the last interview he's done.
How does all this make you feel? I mean, not to jump right into it, but let's jump right into it. Your son is the leader of the Church of Scientology. You have distanced yourself from the church. That's an understatement. We'll get into that in just a second. But what's going on in your head, Ron?
Well, first of all, when I left, and I didn't just leave, Seth, I escaped. On March 25th, 2012, my wife and I actually escaped from the base, which is located near Hammett, California. It was 9 o'clock in the morning that we drove out that gate and turned left, and that was it. I couldn't stand living that life anymore. So it's true, I distanced myself from them. But let me just give you a little picture of what happened, and you'll see how I come to even write the book or even be on the air talking to you about Scientology. I left on March 25th, 2012. We drove across the nation, went to my wife's mother's place in Whitewater, Wisconsin. And about a year and a half later, two private investigators were caught who had been spying on me for a year and a half, getting paid $10,000 a week to do this. The father, his name is Dwayne Powell, was caught looking at a house across, well, around the corner from my house with the purpose of buying it so he could just be in that house and spy on me. It'd make his job easier. When they caught him, he started giving the police officer a bunch of crap. Finally, Nick said, "Hey, listen, you're under arrest, man." And he said, "Do you mind if I look in your trunk?" Guy said, "No." In the trunk of that van, they found 5 license plates from different states, 5 handguns, a stun gun, 2 rifles, 1 fitted up with a homemade silencer, and over 2,000 rounds of ammunition. Now, when that happened, that infuriated me, just say the least. And I tried to get in touch with David, which he was not available to me. As a matter of fact, he put an attorney on the phone to talk to me in lieu of him. And the attorney, Michael, said, "Ron, David doesn't want to talk to you. He doesn't feel he can trust you." I mean, could you imagine this? He has PIs following me armed, but he doesn't think he can trust me. Okay. In talking to Michael, I said, "Listen, just knock off this following me around stuff. I said, I just don't like it." Went back and forth with him for about 15 or 20 minutes. I went nowhere, so we just hung up and ended it. Now, when these guys were caught, they were interrogated by the police. And they said, they meaning Daniel Powell in his interview, and if anybody wants to hear this, you can go on Tony Ortega's Underground Bunker. Those interviews are available to listen to. Daniel said, "One day, I'm out shopping." This is in a place called Aldi's, which is a grocery store in Janesville, Wisconsin. And it was the summertime, and I was bringing out groceries to the car, and I had a pocket T-shirt on. Now, in my left-hand pocket, I had my cell phone. So I bent over to put the groceries in the car, and I thought the cell phone was going to fall out. So I grabbed my left chest with my right arm. The PIs were in a car looking at me. And it said, the one of them said, "Hey, look, it looks like the old man's going to have a heart attack. What shall we do?" So Dwayne Powell, who's the father of the two, excuse me, he's the father and his son is Daniel Powell. They work together, called their contact. Guy got on the phone, said, "Hang on a second." A couple minutes later, a gentleman got on the phone, identified himself as David Miscavige, and said to them, "Listen, if it's his time to die, let him die. Don't do anything. Don't intervene." Now, I heard this interview. Nick Pye, who is, well, he's a lieutenant in the West Dallas Police Force here. He had me listen to it. Even with that, I was not going to write a book. All I wanted to do was just live my life, but I wanted to be in communication with my daughters. So what we did, because they stopped talking to me, in the summer of 2013. Up to that point, they hadn't been in daily communication with me. So we got in the car, we went to Florida, and I was going to go to their house and present them with a DVD of this interview to show them what had happened and enlighten them on the fact that all is not, you know, rosy with the Church of Scientology. Because when you're a member of the church, you're forbidden to go on the internet and see any bad news or any bad stuff about Scientology. Anyway, we got within 50 miles of Clearwater, and I was trailed by three PIs all the time I was down there. Went to my daughter Lori's place. There was nobody home. Went to Denise's house. Her husband came to the door. And I went back and forth with him for about 20 minutes. Says, Jerry, I'd like to speak to Denise. He's, well, I'm sorry, you can't do that. And by the way, she's not here anyway. What you have to do is handle this with the church. I said, Jerry, this is bullshit. I'll go nowhere. The only way to resolve this is if I can speak to Denise herself. After about 20 minutes, I said to him, Jerry, what does this mean? He said, Ron, Denise and I are through with you and Becky forever. At that point, I decided to write this book. That was the exact point. Up till then, even with the PIs having a rifle with a silencer, I wasn't going to do anything. I was willing to let it slide. That's how come this book came about. And with that little bit of a backdrop, I guess we have a better way to do this interview.
Many of us who are familiar with the stories about Scientology are familiar with stories about coercion and spying and sort of the strong arm tactics. But I mean, they pop open the trunk, they find all these weapons. What are they going to do with the weapons? I mean, you know, that's the next obvious question. Are they going to take you out? Is it just a scare tactic? I mean, why load the trunk with guns and ammo, man?
Well, I'll tell you, these guys were like Walter Mitty types. Look, they made a great living dealing with the church because the father worked for the church for years. You're getting paid big money. You know what I mean by Walter Mitty types?
I do.
They think they're doing something great, you know, following me around like I'm a big-time drug dealer. Look, I'm a guy. I want to enjoy my life. I'm a musician. I wanted to play gigs. I sell an exercise apparatus called an Exergenie that I've used for 52 years. I've written a couple humorous books. That's all I wanted to do, and I wanted to talk to my daughters. Now, once they took him in for interrogation and they brought up this silencer, they started singing like canaries because, truthfully, as a private citizen, you just can't go around with a silencer on a rifle. So this guy was indicted for that by the state of Wisconsin. But once that came about, he started saying, look, we didn't mean any harm to the old man, which I have a tendency to believe him. And they used that for target shooting.
Target shooting with a silencer. And, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, that's my first thought.
No, when I say they're Walter Mitty types, unless your audience knows what I'm talking about, there's an old movie with Danny Kaye, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, where he works for a publishing company, but in his mind, he becomes this incredible pilot that shoots down German planes and all these things. So maybe in their mind, they thought they're going to be like James Bond type guys. What the fuck is this, man? I'm just trying to get on with my life.
Well, I want to go back to square one here in just a second. I want to go back to your introduction to the church way back in the day. But first, it's interesting. You know, I'm doing some basic show preparation in advance of our conversation. I go to Google your book, and there's a website about your book, but it's not your site. It looks like the Church of Scientology has tried to get in front of the book Ruthless by exposing you as a charlatan, as someone who's, you had it great with the church, and now you've betrayed your own kind, and you're an opportunist. It looks like a self-conscious attempt to try to make sure you're discredited before anybody ever cracks the cover.
You're being gracious when you say just those things. I'll tell you what they did. Are you familiar with GoDaddy, or you think many of your listeners are?
They are, indeed.
Okay, GoDaddy is a place where you'd go to buy websites. The church bought over 500 variations of my name. That's more than they spent on websites for Mike Rinder, Leah Remini, Tom DeVock, all of the other people combined. And it's a character assassination. So no matter what combination you put in on my name, it'll take you to their hate side of me, which they do this to everybody who leaves, but they did it to me in spades. I mean, I worked with a guy, Peter Schles, for like over 20 years, and he comes on and says I was a personal embarrassment to him. I think they may have said when I would come home totally drunk out of my mind and beat my wife so bad that she'd have to run for her life. And just unbelievable stuff.
Now, here's a quote from the website. It says, any father exploiting his son in this matter is a sad exercise in betrayal. That's the third paragraph on the website's homepage.
Well, I hope people look at this with an eye to think, hey, wait a minute. Well, okay, I'm going to tell you something. When I was 70 years old, David and my two daughters chipped in and bought me a car for my birthday. They bought me a car, which I'm driving now. On my 75th birthday, my daughters sent me 75 gifts. And then, because I couldn't get any time off to see them, Lori went to see David and said, listen, if Dad can't come to see us, we want to go to see him. Just imagine, they had to ask David if they could come and see me. So they came to California, and we spent about 4 or 5 days at Celebrity Center just hanging out together, watching videos, just enjoying each other's company. That was my life and my love for my children. Now I leave, and all of a sudden, I'm this beast. Something doesn't make sense, if you have any sense when you're reading this. And that's all I have to say about
it. Wait, you had to go and to visit your daughters, you went to like a third-party location? I mean, what's a Celebrity Center?
The Celebrity Center is a it's a renovated hotel. It's on Franklin in Hollywood. And it is where, like, Tom Cruise would go for services when he first came in, or John Travolta, or any celebrity of that nature, or maybe somebody in the, like a great musician. This is where the artists go. And yeah, they couldn't come to where I was staying, and I didn't want to go to a hotel, so we stayed at Celebrity Center. And I paid for the room, too. We didn't get it free.
Ron, how old are you, my friend?
I just turned 81.
Congratulations and happy birthday. How old were you when you first got involved in Scientology?
I was about 33 years old. That was in 1970.
What happened in 1970 to get you wired in with this cult?
Well, it was prior to that that I first heard about Scientology. And I had a friend, a fellow musician, Nelson Sandy. He's a very interesting guy. He said to me many years ago this line. He says, I used to be a doctor, but I lost my patience. It's still a funny line to me. We were playing a gig. He's a singer. And we got off the stage one time and went over to the bar. And a guy came over and said, Nelson, can I buy you a drink? He says, no, but can I have the money? He could always come up with straight lines that way. So Nelson said to me, Ron, how would you like to make an extra $100,000? This is in the late 60s. And in those days, you know, that's a lot of money. I said, I'd love to. So he introduced me to a multi-marketing scheme called Holiday Magic. I got involved in it. So we went to what we called an opportunity meeting where we'd present this to public and try to get them involved and make money that way. And I'm standing next to a person talking to somebody, and she's talking to another person standing next to the person I'm talking to. His name was Mike Hess. And Mike said to her, I'm a Scientologist. And I said to the fellow I was talking to, hang on a second. I said, what is that? For some reason, that rang a bell. That rang a bell, and I pinned him down for about a half an hour and had him tell me all about Scientology that he could fit into that time. So I thought it was interesting. And one of the things he said to me was that if you become a Scientologist, you don't ever have to take another aspirin. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, he gave me this little drill to do. He says, if you get a headache, do this, and it'll go away. As well, I don't have a headache right now, so I can't try it out. But anyway, a couple of weeks later, I'm driving down one of the interstates in New Jersey, which is where I lived. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, I got a headache. I tried it, and the headache went away in an instant. Well, I couldn't believe this. I thought, hey, wait a minute. I got to try this out. There's something here that just really a little bit mysterious, but I got to check it out. So I started going to a place in Woodbury, New Jersey, run by a guy by the name of Frank Ogle. He had a cafeteria. So we used to go there. I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday night. And he would introduce various tenets of Scientology, and we'd drill them or talk about them. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, I figured, I got what it is, and I stopped going. And then, and this is really the turning point, I think, for many of us, not just David. David, when he was born, was cursed with a terrible asthmatic case. I mean, even as a little kid, sometimes he'd turn blue. He just, when you're asthmatic, at least in his case, he could breathe in, but he couldn't blow the air out. And man, I'll tell you, I tried all kinds of unusual things to try to handle him. The one thing that would work, I would take him to a doctor in Burlington, New Jersey, and he'd give him a shot of adrenaline, and that seemed to cool it off. But I figured this is not good for a little kid to get these shots all the time. So anyway, I decided I would take him to see Frank Ogle and have Frank audit him. Now, that's a term in Scientology. You could say auditing or counseling. They are synonymous. With the one exception, though, when a person audits you in Scientology method, they don't evaluate for you. That is, they don't tell you what to think or make you wrong for anything you should say. It's pretty open communication that you have, but it's guided. And the whole purpose of it is to have you come to your own awareness of how you may have gotten into this traumatic experience you're having, or maybe asthma, and lead you to handle yourself. I got him out of school one day, and I said, David, I'm going to take you to see a Scientology auditor. So we went down. Frank Ogle took him in session. 45 minutes later, he come out. I said, hey, how's it going? He says, Dad, I'm handled. He was bright, smiling, and I'll tell you, it put that asthmatic case in remission. It's not that it cured it, but he never had another serious attack as a young man. Now, when that happened, I thought, you know what? I'm going to get my whole family involved. And I started taking my whole family down to a mission in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, run by a guy by the name of Norm Muller. That's how we got started.
How old was David at the time?
I guess David was about 9 years old at that time. Well, he took to Scientology like a fish takes to water. And you could see why. I mean, it was the thing in his life that turned it around, because Jesus Christ, man, there'd be sometimes at night, like all of my other kids were healthy. They were strong, healthy. But this is the one thing. Sometimes at night, I could hear him wheezing, and I'd go in the room and just hold his hand for a little while to comfort him. It was terrible, and it handled it, you know?
I used the word cult earlier. I did so on purpose. Was it a cult when you started?
You know, I don't know if you would call it a cult then, because, boy, in those days, like when in 1970, when we got into Scientology proper, it was like for the free spirit. You'd go in there, there'd tons of people going in for services. At the bottom of the bridge, the whole thing about Scientology is called the bridge to total freedom. At that entrance point, there were courses you could do. There were communication skills you could hone up to be better at communicating. And a lot of these things you could get and go out into life and be more capable of handling life. You actually become more able than before you started. But over the years, and as the further on you got, it changed. Right now, I would say it is a fundraising cult. And of course, when you get in, the things that you do are doable and they help you, and that gains your confidence. But the further on you get in, the more things you're told, you may have doubts as to whether it's true or not, but you figure, well, everything they've told me so far is true, and I'm going to believe this. You accept it. But the one thing they promise that's never been delivered is these superhuman abilities where you can, as a spiritual being, leave your body and operate without any mechanical means. In other words, leave your body, go to Germany and read a newspaper. That, my friend, has never been delivered to anybody that I know of.
Scientology is like the onion, right? They start you with lifestyle stuff, how to be happier, how to have a more balanced life and family and work, and how to just be a better, happier human being. And then as you peel back the layers, we get into some of the heavier, more sci-fi type stuff, right?
Yeah. And I'll tell you something. If they just stuck to those things that help you in life, I don't know if it might be one of the greatest self-help movements ever, if it was just that. But inherent in that cult, they sowed their own seeds of destruction when they started telling people you could do all these miraculous things. And the further in you get, the more costly it is. People mortgage their homes to pay for this. And a lot of them get into financial difficulty doing it. And they just keep on going after that carrot.
Well, the whole thing kind of sounds like a trap, right? At $1,000 an hour and you're buying your own e-meter for what, $5,000? And your people are doing triple mortgages and life savings and all that stuff. It sounds like at the beginning, they make you feel good. They make you feel secure. They create a family bond. And then before you know it, you're writing monster checks.
Yeah. You know, the reason it sounds like a trap is it is a trap. You know what I mean? It's not something like if it quacks, if it has web feet and has a bill, it's a duck. Jesus Christ, man. Look at what you're looking at. Okay.
All right, so wait, it's the 70s, it's the 80s. When did David Miscavige come to prominence? When did he achieve sort of the top-tier position in Scientology?
Well, I'll tell you, and I should back up on that story a little, because we had been in for a couple of years. We got so much out of as a family, I decided to take my whole family to England. And we went over there in, I guess it was 72, for about a year and 3 months, came back for a few months, went back over for another year and 3 months. We had a hell of a good time. I got to tell you that. I mean, the second time we went over, I got a recording contract with Polydor Records. I got a writer's contract with Chappells. I was asked to play on BBC. And as a family, it just, you know, I thought it was very worthwhile. But then there came a point when David's in school. This is in Pennsylvania, a little town called Broomall. I came home from work one night and he's laying in bed and kind of holding his hands behind his head. And I said, "What's up, Dave?" He says, "Dad," he says, "I don't want to go to school anymore." I said, "What happened?" He's, "Listen, all the kids are on drugs. They don't listen to the teachers. It's terrible." He's, "I'm not getting anything out of it. I don't want to live this way." He's, "I would like to help L. Ron Hubbard." I thought, oh, Christ, you know, he's only 16. And I thought to myself, well, when I was 17 years old, I decided I wanted to join the Marine Corps. My dad had a sign for me. And I remember going in his insurance office with the recruiter. And he says, "Ronnie, are you sure you want to do this? For God's sake, these Marines are the first ones in." And I said, "Yeah, I do." You know, be honest with you, you got to be a little nuts to join the Marines. And I qualify on that point. I got to tell you, man. But I'll tell you, when I went in boot camp, first night in boot camp, I said, "This is the worst effing thing I've ever done in my life. Worst effing mistake I've ever made." About 12 weeks later, maybe it was 10 or 11 or 12, at the end of boot camp, I said to myself, "I can make myself do anything." And I gained that discipline that you can only get in the Marine Corps or maybe the SEALs, but that stood me in good my entire life. So now I thought, I was 17 when I decided to do that, and it turned out really good for me. He's only 16, but already he's an auditor. He's going to be helping people. And mind you, I was a dyed-in-the-wool Scientologist at the time. It would be like, you know, that I thought was a great honor that he'd want to join the SEA organization. So I said, "Okay, if that's what you really want to do, Dave, I'll help you out." And I bought him clothes and I gave him money and I bought a ticket. And the day after his 16th birthday, we went to the Philadelphia airport and he got on a flight and went to Clearwater and joined the SEA organization. About 8 months later, he found himself working right with L. Ron Hubbard on this movie set when they were shooting movies. So his rise was always there. It was maybe in spurts. I'm sure he did get in trouble a couple of times. He worked his way through it. But where I feel was the big turning point was this. And as I said earlier, when he had that auditing session with Frank Ogle, it didn't cure it, but it put it in kind of remission. When he was in the SEA organization, he had a terrible asthmatic attack, and they had to take him to the emergency room. When he came out of the emergency room, and the person that picked him up was Paul Grady, that's who took him there, so he was there to pick him up. He said to Paul, he said, "Paul, I had a realization, and it's this. Power is assumed. It is not granted." That was the realization that I feel put him on the way to the top, because from that point on, he just moved people out of the way who were in disagreement with them, replaced them with people who would be in agreement and trusted him, and he trusted them, and he just went right to the top.
I'm talking here with Ron Miscavige, the father of David Miscavige. I want to talk to you about your book, Ruthless, here in just a few. Is David Miscavige inside the church considered a kind of God?
Well, he's considered, I don't know if you call him a savior, but an example, the big thing that he did that really cemented his leadership is he got the church tax exemption with the IRS. And that was the thing that if he hadn't pulled that off, it would have been the end of the church, because the IRS wanted so much money in taxes that, first of all, the church didn't have it. It would have wiped them out, and he got them tax exemption. So he's looked at as their great leader. And I'll tell you something, if his powers and capabilities were put to something that was worthwhile with no agenda other than what you're saying, I think he could head up a lot of different things. And he has the personal charisma and intelligence to do that. But the way Scientology has gone, it has gone from Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde. It went from, as far as I'm concerned, back in the 70s and late 60s, a self-help organization that you literally could be helped in your capabilities, made better in life, to what it is now is it's a fundraising thing. And they're buying churches and they're saying they're expanding. They buy these real estate things and say, "Look at all the expansion we're doing." My friend, air is in those buildings, not people. There ain't no new people coming in. I mean, unless you're like a shepherd or a guy who lives someplace where there's no internet, I don't know who would go into a church these days. It's been exposed for all of its faults too many times.
Well, Ron, there are many who would say that, and they would say convincingly that the church was a scam to begin with. You know, L. Ron Hubbard, sci-fi writer, comes up with a story, finds a way to make tax-free income, establishes a church. I mean, it sounds like a pretty good gig.
Well, don't forget, there was no internet back in those days. I mean, it's easy to look back and say, well, gee, we know all these things now. How do you know these things? Probably from the internet. There was no leaking of information like that in those days. And he was made out to be a god. Well, not necessarily a god, but a person who had all the answers to life. People didn't know that he was on the run. He was on the lam. That's the reason he started the Sea Org, so he could go out into sea so they couldn't get him and serve papers on him.
I think it was Harlan Ellison, the famous author, who had said that he had overheard L. Ron Hubbard say, you know, a great way to make tax-free income would be to establish a church. Now, granted, I guess it's still hearsay, but it was a report by someone. And, you know, it's an ingenious plan, isn't it, in the United States of America, when you can live a tax-free existence by establishing a church. The Church of Scientology has certainly benefited. How much do you think they're worth these days?
Well, I personally don't have, I'm not privy to information like that, but the number that has been attributed to their wealth is about $3.5 billion. Now, that I don't doubt it, to be honest with you, because the IAS, which is short for International Association of Scientologists, is really rabid on getting members to join the IAS, donate money. And by the way, that's a great gig. You know, if you give them like $50,000, you're a patron. You get a piece of paper in exchange for the 50 G's. You know, it's low overhead.
Now, wait.
What the hell,
now,
you know?
Does the church hyper-target celebrities, multi-million-dollar movie stars, for their money? I mean, I know some of it's got to be public relations in the face, the Tom Cruises and the John Travoltas. But, I mean, there certainly has to be some serious cash coming out of these big bank accounts, right?
Yeah, but no, they do not target them for big donations. They want to cater to them. They want to cater to them and satisfy every whim. So these celebrities, no matter what, I mean, they're treated like kings as long as they stay within the fold and don't question anything. There are other people who are whales. I don't know if you ever heard that expression, a whale. It's a person who has a lot of money. And there's one who sold a cure for cancer, but something to do with cancer treatment. He patented, I think he got a couple $1 billion. So you have that kind of cash, you don't mind throwing, here's $10 million, you know, or here's $50 million. And they have many people that way that are literally keeping the church afloat. But as far as people coming in and doing services, which in the old days, which in the 70s, the way they stayed in business is they would get people to pay for services, and what was left over they could keep and build up the coffers that way.
So you go from comfortably behind the church wall. You're proud of your son. Look at him grow. Look at him achieve a position of prominence. Your family is a Scientology family. You get from there to writing an expose and coming out to speak publicly out against the actions and attitudes of your very own son. Where did the seeds of doubt start?
I got a Kindle from my son David for, I think it was a Christmas present. And for some reason, the security guards didn't want me to have that. But since David gave it to me, that was, you don't mess with that. There's no way they could say, you got to turn that into us. And I couldn't figure out what the hell the big deal was. Now, when you're on that base in Hemet, California, you're living on a compound. You're living behind a fence that has barbed wires pointing out as well as pointing in. You can't go off that base to go shopping for the normal things. You'd go, let's say, to a Walmart, which is about 2 miles down the road. You have to buy everything on the internet, or they have a type of PX, a little shop on the base where you buy your stuff. All your mail is checked out. You put it in an envelope that's unsealed. Security reads it. If there's anything wrong with it, they send it back. You have to correct it. So everything is censored going out as well as coming in. All your mail is opened and checked out. You can't get on the telephone without somebody else being on the other end. So now you live your life doing your job, spending a couple of hours a day on study, going to meals, and that's all you do day after day after day. You wake up maybe 9 in the morning, have breakfast, go on study for a couple hours, go to lunch, work in the afternoon, go to dinner, work at night, work till 10, 11, 12. Sometimes people work all through the night if there's an event coming up. You live that life, but you think what you're doing is of benefit to every man, woman, and child on this planet. Because of that, and that's the hook, because people who really join the SEA organization do it because they think that Scientology is the most valuable technology there is. And all we have to do is send it out, make good public relations about it, and have people apply it, and their lives are going to be improved. So you think you're doing the good for everybody, the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Getting back to this Kindle, I had the one with the mechanical switch that goes to the right, it goes to the left, goes up, it goes down, and it goes in. So I'm looking up a word one day in something I'm reading. You select the word and you press it to the right and it says search the dictionary. I pressed it a little too far and it said search Google. I'm on the internet, and I'm on the internet without a filter. So now I start looking up things about the church, about L. Ron Hubbard, not that. Jesus Christ, man. This is a joke, man. I give you one example. There's a girl there on the base. Her name is Annie Tidman. She was with L. Ron Hubbard when he died. She was a faithful messenger with him right up to the moment he died. Annie's on the base. She gets lung cancer. She was a heavy smoker. They send her to L.A., to get treatment and live there. And they sent a handler there, somebody who would take care of her every day. And we would hear news. I'd say, how's Annie doing? Oh, she's doing great. I go on the internet. I find out she died 6 months earlier. Nobody on the base knows this. Coincident with this, I'm out one day. I'm going to go into our laundry area. And there's about three girls out there. Said, oh, Ron, do you want to chip in some money? We're buying Annie a birthday present. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, they're either part of the cover-up or they don't know it. And they're unknowingly contributing to this story that's going on that Annie is still alive. Those are the types of things you're sheltered from. You don't know about all these things that are going on in life exposing Scientology. But you can go on the internet maybe to buy some simple amenities in life. Anything that has to do with Scientology or David Miscavige, you can't get on those sites. So that you're leading a life in a bubble, that you're only told things that they want you to hear. Does that make any sense why you would stay there?
The cult atmosphere, the sort of patriarchal we'll take care of you atmosphere, the we're all in it for the greater good atmosphere. But at this moment, as you're starting to see this information come in, what are your thoughts about David?
Well, okay, the ruse is being kept up by any means, and it's being kept up with the people there by keeping information away from them. But look at the people who are there. Many of these people at that base have been in Scientology 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 years, some of them, or on staff for like 30 years. We got $30 a week when I first joined in 1985. Then it went up to $50 a week. You don't save money getting paid that much. If they were to leave, what would they do? Many of them, their relatives have died. They have no skills in life. They don't have a car. They have no place to go. So they kind of live the gray existence of being there and figure, well, at least I'm getting fed. I have a nice place to sleep. And, you know, hopefully we'll get more of this information out to man to make his every man, woman, and child's life better, which is the big lie right there. There's no, talk about clearing the planet, right? You've heard that. Listen, they haven't cleared one street, and it's been around since 1950. You're going to clear the planet? Start with the street.
And what do you do? Do you call David up? Can you call David up and say, hey, I've got some concerns, my son?
Here's what happened. And this was all leading to my leaving. When I was there, I ran the music department for many years because this is my specialty in life and in sales also. But I was a good musician. By the way, I still do anywhere between 6 and 10 gigs a month. So just I haven't given that up. And I enjoy the hell out of it.
Good for you.
But we got a new music director. I didn't want to have the job anymore. It was just too much work for me. And he was of the modern school of music where there's no melody and it's just all kinds of riffs that you put together. And I just couldn't quite grasp it. And I would write melodies day after day, week after week, month after month, and it all get disapproved. And I figured, wait a minute, I can't live this way. I'm not doing anything productive. I'm getting paid. So I sent a note to Dave. I said, listen, I'd like to talk to you, please. So I got together with him and I went over. I said, listen, Dave, I'm living a life of none of my production is of any value. I just can't live this way. Look, I'm not a guy to go on welfare or collect unemployment checks. I've never done it in my whole life. I started playing as a professional when I was 13 years old. I've never been out of work at anything I've ever done. So I said, can you get me another job? I says, I don't care if I wax cars in motor pool, but I want to get something where I'm my productivity gives me something that I'm proud of. He says, okay, I'll look into it. He never looked into it. And some months later, I finally said to Becky, Becky, we got to get out of here.
When we come back, we're going to hear the story of Ron Miscavige's escape. I mean, a literal escape from the Church of Scientology. That story after this. Quick reminder that those who support me on Patreon get a completely ad-free, commercial-free version of this broadcast, and they get a bonus show every single month. So if you get benefit from the broadcast and you'd like to become a Patreon supporter, you can go to patreon.com/Seth Andrews. And thanks so much for the support there. patreon.com/Seth Andrews. I continue my conversation here with Ron Miscavige. He's the father of David Miscavige, who, of course, is the head of the Church of Scientology. Ron Miscavige, in his 70s, realized that he stood apart from the teachings and practices of Scientology, the church that his son was the leader of. And so he escaped. And he tells the story of that escape right here. Ron, tell us, how did you bust out?
We planned our escape for 6 months. And on March 25th, we went to, there's two gates on that compound. One is the main gate where all the security guards are. And then there's one down the road a couple hundred yards. And that's a gate that you can go from the south side to the north side. I conditioned the guards into my going through that gate every Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, because in our rooms, we couldn't have a refrigerator or a coffee maker or anything. So at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, which is time to clean your rooms, I would drive across through that gate, go to the studio where there was a refrigerator, and I would keep Italian salami in there or maybe Parmesan cheese. And then I'd come back through the main gate and give the guards a piece of cheese or salami. So basically, I was feeding the watchdogs. So now March 25th, 2012, we're in the car. It's loaded up with all the belongings we could take with us. And I know that there's only two guards on duty. One is in the main booth, and the other one's in our mess hall, which is on the way to that second gate. So I went past that, and I saw the chase car, because they have a car they call the chase car. And that's a car that a guard would get in and chase somebody if this escape, try to get him back. Do you believe this? This is like, almost like I'm making up this stuff.
This
you know
is
what
a
mean?
Movie, Ron. This is a movie, you know?
Then let me tell you, every time, sometimes I'll reread the book just to freshen myself up with all the things I've said in there, you know, for the interviews. And I think, Jesus Christ, did we actually do this? And to boot, I was 76 years old at the time. Now, we go past that, and I see that his car is there. Now, I know that I go to that gate, and if I can get that open without being questioned, Lars, who's in the main booth, would have to call, Sal, get up here. Sal would have to get up from the breakfast table, go to the car, go up to the main booth for him to tell him what happened. Now, I go to that second gate, and our car's loaded up to the top. I press the button, and I'm hoping, oh, God, I hope he doesn't call me up to the main booth, because if he does, I'm sunk. I press the button, and there's a video on there where you can see who it is. All that happened is the gate started opening. We drive out the gate, and I said, Becky, we're turning left. And I'll tell you something. I tromped on that throttle because I knew I had to get to a point where a decision would have to be made by Sal. And if I went as fast as I could, he wouldn't be there or even in sight of me. At that point, there's a road that went to the right, went to Route 10 to go to L.A., straight would be Route 60, which also went to L.A. Left would go into the town of Hemet, and I could get into the boondocks. I turned left and I'm watching out the back window, which you could see for 400 or 500 yards. His car hadn't come there yet. I got into the boondocks and we were free.
Ron, I would come watch your movie, you know, Ron Miscavige, on the run kind of thing, yeah. You know, it's amazing. Well, you know, I was struck by something you said earlier. You were talking about when David was a young man, when he was 9 years old, when he was 16 years old.
Yeah.
And then you talk about having to go and ask for just the basics. You know, you're asking for a change in your own livelihood or what you can do. The parental role sort of changed at some point. He became the person that was your overseer, or at least was positioning himself as your overseer. You were the dependent who had to come and ask for permission. It's a weird, from the outset, maybe I'm wrong, it looks like a role reversal taking place.
Yeah, it is. But I'll tell you this. One of the things you got to realize is that on that base, the family doesn't mean anything. As an example, when he spoke to me, he called me Ron. He didn't call me Dad. I was a staff member first. No spiritual being is considered to be the father, the mother, the son, the daughter of another spiritual being. And it's not looked at as a father. It's you're a staff member. You're here working to change planet Earth to make it better for everybody. Okay. But when he sent me like birthday gifts or Christmas gifts, it was always dear Dad. And look, there were some moments where I enjoyed his company and he enjoyed mine, but you get in a position like that, and what's affecting everything is this. And this was said by a guy by the name of Lord Acton, an English guy. He was a member of Parliament. He was born around 1834 and lived into the early 1900s. He said, and I'm sure you've heard this, power tends to corrupt. That's an exact quote, by the way. And then he also said, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, I'm going to tell you another thing he said that very few people know, but you can look this up. Great men are almost always bad men.
So now you're gone, right? Now the power no longer belongs to the church. You've taken control of your own lives. You and your bride abscond. You take off. And what do you think's going on in David's mind? I mean, I know it's speculation, but you... I mean, to a degree, knew David. You had to think, holy shit, the guy's going to, he's going to circle the wagons, right? He's going to send out the cavalry for us.
Well, nobody contacted us for almost 2 weeks because they thought I was going to go to my daughter's places down in Clearwater, Florida. But when we left, I didn't pay for gas, food, lodging. With my credit cards, I paid cash for everything. Because if you use a credit card, they can trace it and they'll know where you are exactly.
They're wired in enough with financial institutions to be able to just track your movements as you go.
Hey, listen, they have a travel agent on that base. And he can tell you any flight and anybody on that flight. And they use that to trace people. They use it to track people.
Wow.
So I had to pay cash for everything. Just so we could make our way to Whitewater, Wisconsin. And I remember when we crossed the border from Minnesota into Wisconsin, and I was completely trashed. We made it in 2 days and change, and I couldn't go any further. I said, Becky, we got to get a motel, and I got to get some rest. But meanwhile, on the way there, we stopped at a Walmart and bought one of these flip-top phones, you know? And she called her brother, Donnie, and said, Donnie, I'm coming home. And she heard him yell in the background, somebody get me a drink. Becky's coming home. Of course, they brought in brandy, you know, Wisconsin. I don't know if you know this, but the state of Wisconsin drinks more brandy than the rest of the United States combined.
And good for them, damn it. Good for them. Yeah. That's a great
anyway,
statistic.
So now we're there almost 2 weeks and we're sitting in her mother's house. And oh, by the way, when we got there, man, I'll tell you, I just was chugging down food, you know, buy beer and have a good Miller beer and just enjoy myself, watch TV. And I must have gained 10 pounds in about 2 weeks because you couldn't do that where I was, you know, just free time, just spend time with my wife, you know. Anyway, we were sitting in the kitchen, which is a split level. And I see this girl outside and both there was a woman and a man who came and tried to retrieve me and take me back.
Did your relationship with your wife change? I mean, you can share as much or as little of this as you want, but once you busted out, did the temperature of the relationship you had with your wife change? Were you able to enjoy things more? I don't know. I'm trying to phrase a question, and I'm looking for the words. You know, was it different when you left?
Well, yeah, life was different, but our relationship didn't change, because the one thing about my wife, Becky, is that we just liked each other to begin with. And it just, we had free and open communication. And well, I wish everybody could have an enjoyable marriage as I do, because we've been married now. Hell, it'd be 27 years this summer.
Wonderful.
And that amount of time, I'm going to tell you, and this is one thing we did use that we learned from the church: never go to bed on an upset. Always try to talk it out before you go to sleep. Don't let it carry over till the next day. And in 27 years of marriage, I can tell you, I can count probably on one hand the times we had to stay up and talk us through something.
So your daughters, do you think your daughters, who you now do not have contact with, do you think that it's that they are cordoned off? Are they aware that you would love to see them, that you're desperate to be with them? Or do you think that the church has sort of walled them off? I think what I'm asking is, in regard to the daughters that you are not able to see, do you think it's your daughter saying, "Dad, we're done"? Or do you think the church has built a wall between you and is sort of vilifying you, a character assassination taking place in their eyes of their own father?
Well, let me put it this way. Leverage is how the church operates. The disconnection policy is leverage. Like, give you this example, and then I'll go into what I mean by leverage.
Okay.
It's a form of leverage. I was raised a Roman Catholic, and I used to go to confession to a priest. His name was Father Zidanovich. He was from Poland, and the line to his confessional box was long. And the other priest said maybe one or two people waiting, because they'd give you hell for your sins and they'd criticize you. Father Zidanovich, you could tell him anything. And at the end, he'd say, "That's nice. Say five Our Fathers and five Hail Marys and you're forgiven." And I'll tell you, I'd go and I'd feel great. I'd feel, hey, you know, I'm a kid. I got a fresh start. I'm going to try to be a better kid. They didn't have a digital recorder there recording your voice and a camera pointed at you. And at the end, they would say, "Okay, you're forgiven. But if you ever come out against us, we're going to use all this information against you." That's what the Church of Scientology does, as number one. Okay. Anything that you tell an auditor in an interrogation or a confessional is used against people. But now, if my daughters were to talk to me, they would be declared a suppressive person also. Like Denise has a daughter in the Sea Org. If she talked to me, Tara would never speak to Denise again. She'd be forced to disconnect from her mother. If Lori spoke to me, she'd get fired from her employer, who's a Scientologist. Her friends would stop talking to her. So it's used as a tool to enforce people being cordoned off against, you know, from Scientology. They don't want to hear what I have to say. I'm sure that if anybody were to read my book, they'd be ending up spending tens of thousands of dollars getting interrogated, getting, quote, handled as to what that goddamn person, Ron Miscavige, said.
Your book, Ruthless, it's a declaration of war upon these bad ideas. You know, the church has done great damage to you and your life and has separated you from your kids, and you're sounding the bullhorn. Is that an accurate way to say it?
It is, but I'll put it a little differently. And as I said, when I spoke to Jerry, Denise's husband, at the door when I was trying to talk to Denise, and he said to me, "Ron, Denise and I are through with you and Becky forever." It was right at that point that I decided I was going to write an expose, because if not for myself only, there are tons of people who have been forced to disconnect from their children, from their parents, from friends. And I thought I would get an audience simply because I am David's father. I could do a blog, but how many people would read that blog? A couple thousand, 3,000? I knew that if I wrote a book, I could get great exposure and a lot of people would read it. And the more people we can get to understand that what this church is up to, and you want to call them a church, that's fine. I call them a cult. Okay. When you understand what they're up to, you're going to stay away from that. You don't want to get in a position where you're able to lose your family. And this could happen to anybody. And they would be leveraged into staying away from you. Now, whether they're doing it on their own volition or they've actually gone to the dark side, I hope that's not true. Because, listen, I love my children. I had a great time. Okay, maybe I wasn't the greatest father, but we had a good time together. Look, I taught all of them how to swim when they were 3 years old, how to dive off a 3-meter board when they were 4. I used to have my kids stand around the stove. I'd teach them how to cook. The boys helped me fix the car. We would do projects around the house. Everybody worked together, and we had a ton of fun. And now to lose that communication with them at this late point in my life, I'll tell you, it's not okay. It's really bad.
Beyond what we've spoken about today, what are the types of things people will discover in the book? I mean, give me a broad stroke and I'll point them to the Amazon link in the description box of this broadcast.
Well, I'll tell you what you're going to get out of the book. You will see the story starting with when I was born back in Pennsylvania in 1936, right up to the point that I left. And I'll tell you, you're going to see how this can unfold, and you'll see the transformation of this church from what it was into now what it is. And it's not lovely. And as an added bonus, which is great, because when I got out, I got this book that, there's a guy by the name of John Peterson. He's a fitness expert. And I became friends with him on the phone when I was in the Sea Org. And he told me of a book to get. And he said, Ron, you should read this because you're going to see some things I think are in Scientology. I got the book, and one of the first drills the guy gives you to do is exactly a drill that you do when you're in Scientology. These books you can get on Amazon Kindle. They can't copyright them because they were written in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But you can go on and get these for like a pittance, and you can get data about life and livingness that otherwise, if you went into Scientology, you're going to end up spending a couple $100,000 for, and you'll get it out of these books. If you want to take the time to actually get them and read them and, you know, and educate yourself. And by the way, look, here's how I measure the value of something.
I'm sorry. If you start that phrase again for me, Ron. I'm sorry. Start that phrase again for me.
Okay. And here's the yardstick that I use to measure the value of something. If you apply it in life, does it work or is it bullshit? And if it works, I'll adopt it and I'll use it. And I can tell you this, from reading these books, and now I've made a study of them, because I think this is where L. Ron Hubbard got his ideas. He says that he studied Voltaire and Socrates and all these famous philosophers. I don't think that's true at all. I think he got this from that era of these philosophers who wrote from about the mid-1850s till the early 1900s. And you'll get a cop. You'll actually get the titles of some of these books that I recommend at the end of this book. But you'll see the story unfold, and I think you'll get a true picture of what Scientology is today. And on the other hand, I also believe that it's very even-handed writing. It's not like I'm trying to come off as a victim because, well, it happened. If I were to sit around thinking all the time, oh, woe is me, what kind of life is that? And I hold no hatred in my heart for anybody, because I can tell you what a thing that Nelson Mandela said that I think is a very wise statement. And he said this, holding on to anger is like drinking poison and hoping the other person dies. What a great statement. So that I wrote the book as something that people can get educated as to how it started and how it turned into what it is today, which is not at all what I thought it was going to be when I first got in.
The book is called Ruthless. I will include that link in the description box of this show. One final question, Ron Miscavige. If your son and or daughters were within the sound of your voice right now, and you could say anything to them, what would you want to communicate to your kids?
Call me and let's talk. We can resolve anything with communication, and I hold no hate in my heart for anything that's going on or that has gone on. Anything you may have done where you besmirched me or told things about me that weren't true, I forgive you. And please, let's get back together as a family as we once were.
Ron Miscavige, you're a pleasure to talk to, my friend. You're a great storyteller. You're, I think, a great communicator, and it's an important fight. I'm glad you're making it, my friend. And it's, I think, a hope of all of us that you and your family have a chance for reconciliation. You know, it's certainly a possibility, right? I mean, if you were able to find your way out, we can hope the same for your kids.
Thanks a lot, Zed.
Fascinating conversation. And a fascinating guy. Thanks so much for listening to the show today. We'll be back next Tuesday to talk about Jesus on a fish stick. It's a show about miracles, or the things presented as miracles. Some are going to be fun and funny, some of the stuff we've seen sort of floating around the internet. And some are just serious. They're serious claims of supernatural activity that we're going to examine with a critical eye. FYI, in 2 weeks, I've got Lucian Greaves, the co-founder of the Satanic Temple, on the radio as well. So we've got a lot of cool stuff coming up in the month of March. Thanks again for being a part of the broadcast today. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next Tuesday.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.